They moved them around this corner. There, I think the area of concern for the police keeps switching from one park to another, and I think that benefits us who want to make sure our voices are heard.
All right. And have you seen any altercations or anything?
No.
Yeah,
oh, wait, I did see one. Someone from the alt-right side, there were like two people behind them. They appeared to want to break through the police line to get into the street, and they were immediately tackled, and they were hauled away, I think, by county uniform, the yellow color back on the back of them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Linda.
Yeah, thank you for being down here.
I did see some isolated violent incidents in Chapman Square. At one point, when people began shouting, "Rat," and "We've got a mole," a man came running towards the corner of 3rd and Madison out of the Antifa crowd and was eventually tripped and stomped on briefly by about a half dozen black-clad demonstrators before escaping past the police line. This was easily the most extreme bit of violence I saw while I was in Chapman Square. However, not everybody there characterized the day as being overall nonviolent. Ethan, the man I spoke to about the Proud Boys earlier, had this to say.
But overall, you say it's been pretty peaceful.
You know, I might have a counter to that, and I wouldn't say that it's been peaceful.
Oh, yeah.
Just noting that we do live in a police state, and there have been militarized police officers from not only Department of Homeland Security and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, but Portland Police here that have been visually terrorizing folks and making unlawful arrests. So they also have an LRAD, which you can hear in the background, which is a long-range acoustic device. So I'd say that the it hasn't been the show that Berkeley was. There haven't been a mass number of people who have been brawling in the streets.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Ethan.
Yeah, thank you.
Later, police would round up dozens of people in a so-called kettling maneuver, including journalists and bystanders, and would justify their uses of force against counter-protesters with pictures of makeshift weapons gathered at the site. These events would become a familiar sight throughout much of the next 2 years.
That was the first half of a special that aired in January of this year as part of KBOO's Hindsight 2020 programming, where we looked back at the last 4 years, and in particular, this special looked at the first half of 2017. You can find the full hour of that special on kboo.fm on our show page, Totality of Circumstances. And while you're there, if you can, consider giving a little bit to KBOO to keep us going during this rough patch that we are all going through together. And you can reach us at totalityradio@gmail.com, and we will be back in 2 weeks' time. Stay safe out there.
You are listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight on Transpositive, we have a two-part show. Everything, again, is pre-recorded because of COVID-19. Our studios are closed down, so we're doing everything at home. So tonight, for the first part of Transpositive, we're going to be going back to an old show. We're going to be revisiting an interview we did actually on KBOO radio regarding the case of Andrea Edmo. Andrea Edmo is a transgender woman who is incarcerated in the Idaho Department of Corrections. and who has been seeking gender-confirming surgery for several years now. Her case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where just 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled that Andrea Edmo can go forward with her gender-confirming surgery. So that was a big win, and we're going to revisit an interview we did here on KBOO, which was actually on Prison Pipeline, with Andrea Edmo's lawyer, and this was before the case went to the Supreme Court, but which documents the details of Andrea Edmo's case. And so that's a positive win. And then in the second half of our show tonight on Transpositive, we're going to be talking with actress T.L. Forsberg, who wrote a new play which features a transgender woman as her central character. T.L. Forsberg is a member of the deaf and hard of hearing community and an actress, and has created a new performance which features a transgender woman as her central character. So we'll be talking with her about the intersection of deafness and trans identities, and how she connected with that identity as part of her new work in progress. So that's all coming up here on Transpositive, here on KBOO Community Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma Lugo, and we are here tonight. Our guest is going to be Shalene Shabak. Shalene is an attorney, and she has represented Andrea Edmo. Andrea Edmo is a prisoner incarcerated in the Idaho Department of Corrections who has been seeking gender-affirming surgery. She is transgender, and we're going to be talking with Shalene about Adri's case and find out a little bit more about a recent victory in the Ninth Circuit Court. So, Shalene, are you there? Okay, so while we're waiting for Shalene, we'll just talk a little bit about what's going on with Andrea Edmo's case. Andrea Edmo is an inmate from the state of Idaho who tried to harm herself twice while she was in prison, and she suffers from gender dysphoria. And as a result of her gender dysphoria, she has filed a lawsuit in 2017 with the Idaho Department of Corrections seeking gender-affirming surgery. The Idaho Department of Corrections refused to cover the surgery, saying that it was medically unnecessary and that she did not have a right to pursue this surgery. Andrea Edmo said that she is a woman and she refused to be housed in a men's prison, and she has gender dysphoria, and she deserved medically appropriate treatment, which would be no different from someone who had cancer or a broken leg, you know, just someone who was seeking medically appropriate treatment for her condition. And the Idaho Department of Correction denied her request for nearly 5 years, despite a clear and urgent need for it. The Ninth Circuit Court recently ruled in favor of Andrea, and they said that it was due to the gravity of the facts in her case. Her case attracted national attention because the governor of Idaho personally spoke out against the case and said that he would appeal if there was a victory for this inmate. And he made this a kind of a cause celeb. Anyways, Adri's case received widespread national attention because, there are several complicating factors. One is that Adri was a person of Native American heritage, and so there was a racial bias issue going on with respect to treatment of Native prisoners. But on the other hand, there was also... Hello, Shalene, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. So we're talking tonight about the case of Andrea Edmo, and I would like to thank you for joining us on the air. First of all, can you please tell us a little bit about the background of Adri Edmo?
Sure. So Adri is a Native American transgender woman who's from Idaho, and she identifies as female, although she was assigned male sex at birth. And Adri's been in the custody of the Idaho Department of Correction, which I'll probably refer to as IDOC, since 2012. And she was first diagnosed with gender dysphoria while she was in prison.
So let's talk a little bit about Adri's background, because I've done a lot of research and I listened to that NPR piece, and I've done lots of reading too. Adri had a background which included a history of trauma. Is that correct?
Yeah, she had a difficult childhood.
And also was like moved around between different like foster homes, and she had a challenging childhood. Is that correct?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, thank you. Because I know, as we get into the conversation, I'm going to just bring up the fact that I know one of the reasons that there was so much backlash against Adri's requests was specifically because of what she's convicted of and why she's in prison. So we'll get to that in a minute, though. When did Adri Edmo begin to seek treatment for her gender dysphoria, and what was the response from the Idaho Department of Corrections?
So Adri first began requesting gender confirmation surgery in 2014, and she has been repeatedly denied surgery since then. So that's for about 5 years now. The Department of Correction and its for-profit medical provider, Corizon, have refused to provide her with critical medically necessary care.
And is this analogous to any other like medical request that an inmate might have, like if they had a broken leg or if they had, were requesting treatment for cancer or depression?
Exactly. So what's important in this case is that, you know, Adri's been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. There is no dispute. The defendants agree. All of the experts in this case have agreed. And the evidence here shows that the treatment, the surgery here, is medically necessary and has been withheld. And as you mentioned, so here, surgery is medically necessary in some, not all, gender dysphoria cases. Just like insulin might be medically necessary for a diabetic, or removing a tumor might be medically necessary for someone who has cancer. And actually, the American Medical Association and every major medical organization agree that gender confirmation surgery is medically necessary care, can be, for gender dysphoria.
Now, one of the issues in this case that brought it to national attention was that the governor of Idaho actually became personally involved in this case. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So, as you mentioned, the governor of Idaho, Governor Little, has made a promise that he will take this to the Supreme Court. And, you know, some of his public statements have referred to Ms. Edmo's crime when talking about how taxpayers should not have to pay for this sort of surgery. And, you know, it's a little troubling because no prison system provides different care to people depending on what their sentence is for or what they're incarcerated for. And the Eighth Amendment recognizes that in prison, everybody has the right to medically necessary care. And that's in part because they have no other options. You know, their food, their water, their medication, everything must be provided to them.
And the governor has brought up the issue of the cost of the surgery. That's one of the things that the governor seems to be obsessed with, is this idea of the cost. Is this a costly procedure, or is this similar to any other medical procedure in terms of its cost?
Well, what's interesting about what he's saying is, so he's making the statement that the surgery will be an additional cost beyond what the state already pays to contract medical care with the private corporation, Corizon. But when they contract with Corizon to provide medical treatment, the IDOC pays a set price. And that price doesn't typically decrease or increase based on medical services. So under the terms of the contract, the total cost that they would pay to the medical provider for services should not change regardless of whether she receives the surgery or not.
Right. So the cost of the treatment is actually wrapped up in the overall insurance rider that the state pays. In the same way that when a private individual pays health insurance, the cost of the procedure that they're getting covered is wrapped up within that, within the restraints of that policy. And this particular insurance rider does include gender affirming surgery, I assume, for the state of Idaho.
Right.
That's great. Okay, so I'm sorry I didn't send you this question before we talked, but one of the things that I wanted to make sure to get to was part of the reason that this was considered medically necessary is because Adri did attempt to harm herself twice previously, before this was even really brought to like a high level of visibility. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So Adri Edmo did attempt to castrate herself twice while in prison, and both times she attempted castration, she was unsuccessful, but she was also at the time receiving hormone treatment. And so what that shows is that while she was receiving some treatment, it wasn't enough to alleviate the severe gender dysphoria that she was experiencing.
Right. So what type of conditions is Adri Edmo detained under currently? Is she held in isolation? Is she in the general population? Does she currently serve her time in a men's prison?
She is housed in general population, and she is in a men's prison, and that is because the Department of Correction policy houses prisoners according to their genitalia.
And how is she treated in the prison? Is she respected? Is she harassed? Is she safe?
I think, you know, that's a difficult question to answer. Prison is a very difficult environment, and she is a particularly vulnerable person within that environment. And it has been difficult for her.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues with transgender prisoners, especially at the federal level, but also in many state prisons, is that there is a tendency to simply put transgender prisoners in isolation, because the prison system doesn't really know how to handle having a transgender prisoner. So it sounds like it's a positive thing that Adri is held in general population. Can you comment on that?
I think it would be best if she were in a women's facility.
Has she, in talking to you, has she expressed a desire to be in a women's facility? And how do you think that she would be treated in a women's facility?
I don't want to, you know, disclose things that are within the attorney.
Within attorney-client privilege. I understand. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
That's all right. Let's move on. What were some of the obstacles that Adri faced when bringing her case to the court system?
So, you know, Adri is incarcerated, and she's suing the Department of Correction and its medical provider, the people who have control over every aspect of her life. So even bringing this lawsuit takes a lot of courage. And I'm not sure if you know this, but Adri actually initially filed the case on her own without a lawyer.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And any case is difficult to bring without a lawyer, but even more so if you are incarcerated. But luckily, we learned about the case and came in as counsel.
So she filed the case herself, which I know that takes time when you're in prison. Do you know about how long it's been since she started to pursue legal action?
It's been a number of years.
So right now she's currently serving a 3 to 10 year sentence. So it's been at least 5 years. But once she was able to reach out to your firm, what were some of the obstacles that she faced? Like, can you walk us through the process? How did her case history go? Did she first go to, is there like a prison court that decides this sort of thing? And then it goes to, can you explain how that goes?
Sure. Well, we actually, our law firm, Hetzel Stormer, Rennick, and I, we're actually a civil rights firm based in Los Angeles. And this case is, as you know, in Idaho. So she was connected with some really phenomenal attorneys in Idaho, Ferguson Durham. And they reached out to the National Center for Lesbian Rights, which is in San Francisco. And then that firm, that nonprofit, reached out to us. So we have a team of, you know, really experienced, committed folks that are all helping Adri.
Okay. So I'm just trying to get to understand how the process works. Like, so did she file initially several years ago and then it was rejected and then it moved up the court system? How does that work?
Yeah, so she filed the case first by herself, and I think her first case was actually dismissed, and then she filed again, and the court can do what can actually appoint counsel, can allow a prisoner who's filing a lawsuit alone if there seems to be some legs to that suit, and that's what happened.
So she was appointed a counsel, and the counsel was the ones that hooked you up with her and with the National Center for Lesbian Rights.
Yes, and they're still on the case.
Mm-hmm. So the recent decision that brought this case into the news was that the Ninth Circuit Court ruled in Adrie's favor. Is that correct?
That's true, and it's an 85-page opinion. It's pretty lengthy. I'm not sure if you read all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that decision makes clear that there are decades of Eighth Amendment precedent from the Supreme Court, and this case falls squarely within that. And it's a basic principle of our Constitution that the state must provide necessary medical treatment to the people that it incarcerates.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Ms. Edmo is transgender does not take this case outside of the Eighth Amendment protections.
So it's working specifically within the Eighth Amendment and within the rubric of medically necessary treatment for a prisoner.
Yes.
So what I'm wondering, one of the things I'm wondering is that, I mean, I know that there are other states where there are transgender people who are incarcerated who are seeking surgery. Will this aid them, or is this precedent that's being set by the Ninth Circuit only valid for Idaho?
Well, we hope that this decision will be helpful to other prisoners who are being denied medical care, because it does recognize that surgery is necessary for some people, just like other forms of medical care are necessary for others. But I think there's one important consideration, which is that the Eighth Amendment asks courts to look at the individual circumstances of each person's medical condition. So while we'd hope that prisoners will, look to this decision for guidance, the results of each case will be dependent on their own medical situations. But in terms of, beyond Idaho, we absolutely think this case has implications beyond Idaho. This case is a victory for the Constitution, for the people who believe in the values that it stands for and protects. And it makes clear that we must treat people in our prisons with decency and humanity, and we can't deny them medical care.
Another question I have, I don't know if I sent this one to you ahead of time, but I'm wondering, does this affect federal prisoners as well? Because state prisoners and federal prisoners are housed separately, and they have completely separate policies for the treatment of those prisoners. I would assume that this would also apply to federal prisoners, but I'm not sure. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the Eighth Amendment applies to people in prisons.
Okay, right. So are you familiar with any cases that are currently at the federal level where prisoners such as Chelsea Manning, for instance, who was incarcerated and was seeking treatment, are you familiar with any cases where this may aid in a transgender person who's incarcerated at the federal level?
I'm not at the top of my head, sorry.
Okay, that's cool. Thank you very much. What are the implications of this decision beyond Idaho? I guess we've already gotten to that. What is the future for Adrie Edmo, and when is she eligible for parole? And what are some of her future plans?
So Adrie is set to be released from prison in 2021, but because she needs medical care urgently, we're trying to do everything we can to get that for her while she's in prison. This really is a matter of life and death for her.
Okay. Do you have any idea what her future plans are once she's released?
She's first hoping to get the care that she needs.
Mm-hmm.
And, when she's released, she'll do the things most people do when they leave prison, find a place to live,
mm-hmm.
get a job, get her life together.
Yeah, that's great. So can you tell me a little bit about how this case, working on this case, has how it has affected you? Like, have you gotten to know issues of concern to the transgender community better? How do you see transgender people now after working so closely with Adrie on this case?
I think, as I've mentioned, this case is, even though it is about transgender rights, it is also within the bigger picture of prisoners' rights. And it's completely in step with what's happening around the country. There are several other courts, including in Missouri and Florida, that have ruled that transgender people cannot be denied this sort of care in prison. And the district court's order, and now the Ninth Circuit's unanimous panel, recognizes that. So healthcare providers have known for decades how to provide effective and life-saving medical care to transgender people. And it makes me so sad that prisons and jails continue to ignore that consensus, and because of that, they put patients' lives at risk, and they waste taxpayer funds defending these sorts of lawsuits.
So Idaho's governor has said that he's going to appeal this to the Supreme Court. Are you going to follow through on this case all the way up to the Supreme Court?
Yes, we intend to fight for Adri's right to this treatment, absolutely.
Do you think that the Supreme Court will hear this case, or do you think that they will just let the ruling stay?
Well, as I mentioned, this case is in line with hundreds of other Eighth Amendment cases about medical care, and so I don't think they will take it. You know, after being told by a federal district court judge, unanimous panel of the Ninth Circuit, and in that 85-page opinion that this case is consistent with all of those numerous rulings, there is no carve out for particular kinds of medical conditions or for transgender people. I don't think that the Supreme Court will take it.
Does the outcome of the that's very positive. Although I would not want to deny you an opportunity to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court, which I've heard is quite an honor. But I think it's better for this particular person if it's not brought to the Supreme Court. What about the issue of where Adri is housed? In terms of right now, she's in a men's prison. Do you know approximately how many transgender women, have you come across any statistics about how many transgender women are currently housed in men's prisons? And you probably don't know the answer to that. So let's move on to, do you know what the future is for Adri in terms of like her housing? Do you think that, once she receives her surgery, if she receives it while she's still incarcerated, that she'll be moved to a women's prison? Has the Idaho Department of Corrections made any indications on that?
Well, if they follow their policy, which houses prisoners according to their genitalia, then they should move her to a women's prison.
Mm-hmm. What does this case provide as a case lesson for anyone who... What does this particular case teach us about how transgender women and transgender men can assert for their rights while they're incarcerated? What are some of the lessons that they can take from hearing about this case for self-advocacy and for asserting their rights?
That no one should be denied medically necessary care, and it is considered cruel and unusual punishment to deny treatment to someone who is in dire need of it.
And if they are in need of medically necessary care, what are some of the steps that they can take within their facilities or within the legal system to advocate for their rights?
I know that prisons have their internal grievance processes, and one, you know, great way of starting is by documenting.
So document, document, document.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime that there's, for instance, in Adri Edmo's case, she came to, she presented clear and visible evidence of her gender dysphoria and the steps that she had taken for herself to try to address this. And she also documented where she was denied treatment. Is that correct?
Yeah, she submitted multiple requests for treatment for her condition, and they were denied.
So one thing to do for people who are incarcerated is to submit documentation if services are denied. That was an important part of building a case. So once you have that documentation in place, then how do you get representation in order to get your case heard and addressed by prison officials or by people who may be outside of prison, who may be advocates? What did Adri do to get that kind of attention? And what can people who are currently incarcerated do? Do you have any ideas?
Part of it is luck.
Luck.
There are amazing attorneys out there and so many folks who are willing to do this important work.
Mm-hmm. So trying to figure out how to make your issue visible. It may be through the prison chaplain. That's usually a safe person to go to. Or it may be through trying to learn about who in your community is a litigant who is willing to take on civil rights cases such as this. So those are two possibilities?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, Shalene, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us tonight. If people would like to learn more about Adrie Edmo's case or about the Ninth Circuit Court ruling or about your law firm, do you have any suggestions for where they can look up information about any of those contact information for you or your law firm or to learn more about Adrie's case?
Yes, our law firm website has information about the case. It's hadselstormer.com, HADSELLSTORMER.com. And then also the National Center for Lesbian Rights, our amazing co-counsel. They have, they also have an entire page about this case, about Adrie. All of the decisions are posted there. And that's another way to get information about Ms. Edmo.
It sounds like it's really been an amazing experience for you. How long were you on this case for?
I've been on this case for over 2 years now.
And it's received a lot of publicity. Were you the chief litigant or part of a team?
We're part of a team.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your work, Shalene. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us. And thank you so much for advocating for people who are incarcerated.
Thank you so much.
That was an interview with the lawyer representing Adrie Edmo. And we did that interview last fall. And the good news is that the Supreme Court did refuse to hear the case, which upheld the Ninth Circuit ruling in favor of Adrie Edmo. And so basically, since the Supreme Court did not hear the case, Adrie Edmo was granted her right for seeking gender-confirming surgery within the Idaho Department of Corrections, which means that she can move forward with her surgery. And hopefully we can do a follow-up interview sometime this summer to find out how Adrie's doing and if she's had her surgery. Next up on Transpositive, we are going to be talking with artist T.L. Forsberg about her new one-woman show that features a transgender woman as her feature character. So stay tuned next for an interview with actress T.L. Forsberg here on Transpositive. Good evening. You are listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland. Transpositive uplifts the voices of transgender non-binary folks. And tonight we are very honored to have T.L. Forsberg with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First of all, I need to ask, what are your preferred pronouns?
Pronouns? Just she.
She. And I'm Emma, and I also use she and her pronouns. So T.L., first of all, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, tell us what you do as an artist?
Yeah. I just want to say thank you for asking me about my pronouns. That's one of the things I love about the trans community is that level of respect to slow down and ask people where they're at. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I'm a performance artist in the deaf community. I consider myself atypically deaf because I have hearing abilities and I choose to speak. But I embrace the identity, cultural identity of deaf, which is controversial. And I was a musician in the hearing culture, and I was asked to hide my disability, and I said no. And so I started embracing it, my deafness, and including it in my art. And then I came out in a documentary called See What I'm Saying, the Deaf Entertainers documentary. And inside of that story, I basically showed the world what it was like to be rejected by the deaf culture. So like what it was like to be marginalized within a marginalized community of individuals who were not okay with me using the word deaf. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like during the documentary, I call it my coming out of my closet, because it was the first time I said to my family, this is who I am. And they were like, what? But you could talk and you could hear and you're not like those people. And then, so that was a big coming out. But then I found afterwards, like I got written into a TV show on Switched at Birth playing a deaf character. And then I was getting a lot of pushback from other actors, like, you can't do that because you're taking from us because you have hearing privilege is what they call it. So I went through his whole journey there, and I felt like what happened was in coming out in claiming my deaf self, that my hearing self was being asked to be shoved back in that closet. Like there was a real binary choice. I had to pick one or the other, and it wasn't acceptable. So I've deeply been on this path. I was like 10 years of like being a deaf musician and touring in the deaf culture. And then one day my whole body just, you know, my hair started falling out and I got an autoimmune disease. I couldn't walk and I was in a wheelchair and I was lying in bed and my friend said, "You hit this bottom, girl. You have to figure out what's going on. You better not get out of this bed until God tells you, you know, what it is you're supposed to learn." And I had so much, like autoimmune is where the body attacks itself. And it was a reflection of the self-hatred and shame that I had about not being deaf enough, not being hearing enough, not knowing what to call myself, and feeling displaced between two worlds. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've been on a deep journey with that ever since. And then I started writing this one-woman show about healing love addiction. And in my actual life story, when I went into rehab for love addiction, I worked with an orgasmic meditation coach, a sexuality coach, who happened to be quite fluid. And so there was just like a lot of permission there for me to explore and to play. And that whole community is about really exploring and playing. And I started to excavate my shame around my duality. And so in the actual show, that gets talked about. And I learned to, basically I say, I'm a hybrid. Like I have both parts, and I sort of learn to embrace being in the middle space rather than being victimized by it and claiming it as a power of some kind, and sort of learn to integrate both parts rather than having them fight each other.
So with the character in your play, who is a transgender character, mm-hmm. is a central part of the play. Can you tell me, how did you come to the idea of this transgender character? How did they become such an important part of your story?
Yeah, thank you. I believe it kind of came through my subconscious, and I wrote it that way because I just kept finding myself meeting trans individuals, and we seem to have a similar location of feeling like we were both struggling to accept ourselves or had walked a path of having to find ourselves. So it was important for me to have a character who fiercely understood what the journey of coming out looked like, and also like the rejection inside of it, and the price inside of it, the freedom inside of it, the fragility. And I needed a really strong character who could create permission for me to do that. And I had trans individuals in my life who just were that mirror for me. They were just so loving and accepting. And we found it like shocking about how we both felt sort of like displaced in our own cultures. Like my friends would say, "Oh, it took forever to get the T in LGBT," which my character says in the show. And it says, "Girl, that rainbow was not complete without us, let me tell you." And then basically says what you're experiencing is being marginalized in your own community, and that's there's a weight and a pain inside of it. So it's interesting that the trans it went trans because my original coach was more fluid, and then it sort of transitioned. And I've had some trans people come to the show and say, "Oh, you know, our character's not quite trans, they're a little more fluid," because while she goes by she, her, she actually also one day shows up in male form, masculine and feminine, and is a little more fluid, but chooses to identify as trans.
That's really interesting. Yeah, when you were first telling me your story about your play, and about your, you know, your own personal journey, It sounds so very similar to so many stories that transgender people share about their own experiences as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, it's very challenging to be born assigned a particular gender and
yes.
have everyone in your community tell you that that's what you are, even
yes.
when you insist that that's not what you are.
Right.
And then when you transition to the space that you feel like is your authentic self,
right?
Then you have to try to defend that within
yes.
all kinds of communities. I mean, within heterosexual communities, within communities of the gender that you identify as, mm-hmm. with the gender that you don't identify as, with your family, mm-hmm. of course. And then, you know, if you're dating or interested in meeting other people, then you also have to deal with that quality of it too. Within your own experience, how do you deal with those kind? I mean, talking about your experience as a different kind of experience of transitioning, but mm-hmm. you know, something that you identify with. How do you deal with some of those kinds of related issues within your own personal journey?
Well, I really believe that when we are different, and that can be a beautiful thing, different, you know, deaf people, we don't consider ourselves disabled, which is interesting. The hearing culture would put us in the disabled camp, but we just think of ourselves as diversely abled or a language minority or a cultural minority. But I think that when we are different, it's our responsibility to teach people how to meet us there. Like, because I am a hybrid and fluid and in the middle, I sometimes can move over here and be in the hearing world and talk to people and function quite well. And then I can go to the deaf world. So it's kind of like a superpower that I can move between two. And then I sort of can reflect back to each community what I'm seeing. And like, for example, when I tell people I'm deaf, which is always, it's a decision. It's like a coming out every minute. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. do I tell this person? And then the pullback in the eye and the judgments. And for me, there's bias around what a deaf person's supposed to look like or sound like. Like, quite frankly, people think deaf equals non-speaking. So the fact that I'm speaking, they're just confused by it. Mm-hmm. This is the way it's been branded. It's very unfortunate. So when I tell people that, I usually always have to quantify it. Like, oh, I'm part deaf. I notice like my identity is deaf. And if you spell it with a capital D, it means one thing. And a lowercase d means different D. Like our pronouns just have capital letters and stuff like that. So our identification labels rather. And I noticed that I would just prefer to go by deaf, but I always have to quantify it with people because then they'll just start screaming in my face. So I'll say, mm-hmm. I'm partially deaf or I'm hard of hearing or, and then I felt like I was always watering down my identity. I'm like, why do I have to do this? Why can't I just say deaf? Mm-hmm. Why don't, like, you should rise to, like, the level of education of what the deaf culture is instead of me having to water down my identity to help you figure out how to communicate with me. Mm-hmm. So I flipped the game on its head and said, I'm just going to say deaf. And then people are going to be uncomfortable with it. And it's a place to just re-educate. Mm-hmm. And I would, right? And then I would say 100%, like when I say I'm deaf to someone using the hearing culture, their number one response is, I'm so sorry. And then deaf, like they apologize. And deaf people are often like, that is so condescending. That is so like, don't look down on me. I'm not broken. But as I've gone into that, you know, my superhero has gone into their world and gotten to know them better, I realize that what's actually underneath it is shame and discomfort around not knowing how to be with people who are different. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about when I first saw a disabled person when I was a kid. I saw a gentleman in a wheelchair who was CP and he had like one arm up like this and he was quite contorted. And I remember my mother slapping me on the leg when we were walking towards them and saying, don't talk, don't stare, and don't ask questions. It's not polite. Hello. And so right away, the conditioning with people who are different or other is to not look at them. And then you have this beautiful culture of other that don't get looked at, don't get stared at, and don't get asked questions. Mm-hmm. And it's just so shame-based. So it's good to know that. So today I know a lot of times when hearing people apologize, it's just their own shame and discomfort of like, I wish I knew, I don't know sign language, I feel bad. They just feel awkward. Mm-hmm. God bless them, they just feel awkward. So I've learned to, so what I did with my show was I created a whole row of characters who treat me wrong, who call me disabled, who bring me like a menu in Braille, which happens to deaf people all the time. Like people just go unconscious and are like, oh, you're deaf. And then they bring you a Braille menu. Like they just get uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I created a row of characters. And so that it creates permission for the audience to say, oh, other people also don't know how to be with deaf. And then they laugh at it. And they're like, ha ha, oh, ha ha ha, oh. And that education is getting in through the back door through entertainment, which is kind of what I do. I say I'm an edutainer or a diversity advocate. So that's what I do. I try to educate at the connection point, try to have increased compassion for people's not knowing how to meet it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
how do you think that your experiences, your own personal experiences, working with in between two different cultures might relate or intersect with the identities of a queer person? Do you see connections between your own kind of life's journey and a queer person's journey? And do you think that those experiences make people of different kinds of identities natural allies?
That's such a great question. So I'll ask you just for the sake of clarity, how would you identify queer so we're on the same page?
I think that queer would be however a person chooses to identify it.
Yeah, right. It's a little broad, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
For me, queerness would include transgender, transgender, bisexual,
right.
Lesbian, gay, non-binary,
yeah, right,
probably asexual, and question,
yeah, right, exactly.
But I might also include people who are in BDSM communities, and then anyone who self-identifies as queer.
Yes, exactly. That's so interesting because I have like LGBT deaf friends who are always telling me you're queer. I'm like, why are you? I think they're obviously seeing something in me. So I always feel like energetically queer to me just means someone who's like on the alternative or on the edge and is not quite fully in the group but is a part of the group. So it's just it's so fascinating. Yeah, I definitely would say my experience feels sort of like the bi of, you know, the bisexual experience of being there's a way that both communities will say, well, you're not one or the other, and the rejection. And I have a great line in my show where actually Treva, the trans character, says, girl, you just got to get right with it. You're basically the bisexual of the deaf community, mm-hmm. which is, it speaks volumes about, you know, that fear of other.
Mm-hmm. How do you think it is that when people become identified with a particular identity, how do you think it is that they become so attached to that identity that it's really difficult for them to accept difference?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. The fruits of oppression. Like I observe that out of every minority culture, like you look African-American or Black culture, right? You know, the slavery. And yet here they were, you know, in the fields and they're singing. So out of oppression erupts this incredibly beautiful thing, right? And then like in the deaf culture, there's this oppression, but sign language is this like incredibly beautiful thing, and that came out of that culture. And then because there's been so much oppression from the outside world, you know, in my world, it would be the hearing culture, you know, there's been a fight to preserve itself. And then I actually speak about this on my show, which is the effort to preserve itself. If we don't heal the oppression of that hate, it becomes horizontal hate and we start to take it out on each other. So actually the spiritual call is to somehow work through and forgive the oppressors so that we don't internalize the hatred and then start taking out people in our own communities in an effort to try and preserve ourselves. That's
within,
right?
So within the transgender community, we have a term for people who really don't accept us within the same community that we identify with.
Wow.
The term is called, it's a trans excluding radical feminists. And it's a word to describe feminists who don't accept transgender women because they think they're men. And
Wow.
And they have lots of literature that basically supports and reifies their position. And we within the transgender community who care about this sort of conversation feel very offended by a community of women who don't accept us as women.
Yes.
You know, just because we don't have the same, I mean, everyone has different kinds of bodies.
For sure.
It's like this refusal to acknowledge that there's all kinds of women.
Yes.
Does that sound, does any of that like...
That totally resonates. I mean, literally, there's like, I say it in my show, it's like they celebrated me as the deaf singer because deaf people are fighting in the hearing world to show that they're capable. Like, we're not disabled, we're not retarded, we're not mute. We are capable people, and they're trying to prove that they're equal to hearing people on some level. And then I said, like, they celebrated me as a role model and a celebrity in the culture. It sort of like woke up in me my inner advocate for understanding and appreciating that we have diversely different types of deaf individuals. It doesn't have to look just one way.
So let's talk about your life as an artist, as a writer. Can you tell me a little bit about your career as a writer? Is this your first play?
It's sort of interesting. It is my second. It's like a one-woman show. Mm-hmm. You know, I've predominantly been a songwriter, and that's how I've expressed my writing. And this time it came out this way, and I was so delightfully surprised and discovered I was a writer. And now I'm applying for a fellowship in New York for a theater company who is trying to support diversely abled individuals and who create content for that represent diverse individuals. So I'm excited to be a part of that. So that's going to be kind of cool. So yeah, this is kind of a first in terms of debuting my writing in a very public way, other than my songwriting.
Mm-hmm. And how did the play come to you? I mean, what kind of led up to it in terms of writing that?
Right. So I was sick and had really severe sciatica and was in a wheelchair. And I just thought, if I have to lie in bed for 3 months, I'm going to go crazy. Mm-hmm. So I took an improv writing class on my laptop online. And everyone in the class was there writing memoirs and books and therapists, right? They all had goals on it. And because I didn't, I just wrote whatever. And there was so much there around my deaf self and my hearing self and the hatred and wanting to die, which is another reason why I wanted a trans character in my show, is having watched, you know, the suicide rate in the trans community for people who come out and then transition back, and like the incredible emotional pull inside of it. Anyway, so I just started writing, and it revealed itself, and I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to tell this story. And what was interesting about it was my first thought was, I can't do this show. It's so poetic and deep and intense, and I don't want to sign the whole thing. I want to talk it, but if I do that, deaf people will kill me. Like, I literally feared social bullying on my social media or people attacking me, and I was like shaking. And then I said, you know, that's good enough reason right there to do it. So I consciously decided, it was the first time in 11 years in my artistic platform that I used my speaking voice fully in a show, because I always sign, I always play my music as a recording and sign to it. And so, and then I'm usually in more of a deaf form, one would say. So this is the first time I stood on stage and spoke it and used an interpreter, and consciously kind of let myself experience what it might be like to have deaf people be unhappy with that and have their feelings about it, because I wanted it for my own growth.
So your characters, tell me about the other characters in your play. I know that you're the lead character is a transgender character. her. What role does she have at the play? And tell me about some of the other characters.
For sure, for sure. So Trevor is actually my trans hero. So I'd say myself, TL, is the lead in the show. And it's basically about how I discover that I just keep having the same bad relationships over and over again, and that I admit that I'm a love addict, and that I have abandonment issues, and I'm cycling in these terrible patterns. And then I hire a coach, and the coach who shows up ends up being my friend from FMCC Church, which I'm a member of that community. And I first met the trans character in female form there. And then when the coach comes, they're in masculine form, and I'm like, whoa. And they're like, yeah, I'm fluid. You cool with that? And then we began to have this relationship. And then the character takes me through the whole journey of healing love addiction by unearthing all of the shame that I have about being dualistic. And so Treva is the main hero character. And I, you know, at the end, my character reveals that Treva takes her life. That even though Treva had was kind of the role model for what was possible, I didn't, the original script did not have that, but I kind of modeled the character after Christine Daniels, and from FMCC, and I'd never met Christine, but when I was at the church and I was going through some healing, they gifted me the Christine Daniels scholarship because there wasn't any trans people going to school, and I was working as a sign language interpreter with a trans individual there, and they said, you're going to school, we want to support you, we've heard your story of duality. And I was like so moved by that. I was like, wait, I'm not a trans person, why are you giving this to me? And they're like, there's, trust me. And it was great, and it helped me to finish my school, it helped me to continue to work at the church with the trans community there. But basically, yeah, the whole thing is, oh, and what happened was I remember, you know, what had happened to Christine, which is, you know, losing her rightness and the transitioning back. And I was literally working with someone who, you know, had transitioned, embraced life as a woman, and then would go home, you know, be with their family and go through this harrowing shame attack and spiral, and then come back in masculine form. And my other trans friends saying, you know, the suicide rate's super high when people do that. So I wanted to put a pin in it that the rightness, even though my character goes on a journey to find internal rightness and integration, that there's fragility around it, and we can lose our rightness with who we are at any minute, and it's a constant decision to come out and be right about who we are.
Who is Christine Daniels?
Christine Daniels. Oh, you don't know Christine?
No.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. You're from Portland, sorry. Christine was a sports broadcaster who had transitioned from masculine to feminine and was like a very prominent California trans individual. When she took her life, it really impacted the community, and the church community I was in set up a scholarship to honor the remembrance of that journey and trying to encourage other trans people to, like, you know, live right and out.
Oh, that's nice. So was Christine Daniels a member of that church that you belong to?
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. So there's a scholarship in her memory.
Correct.
Tell me about some of the other characters. Are there any other characters in your play?
Yes. Okay, so there's obviously... there's Treva, there's myself, there's my mom and my grandmother, and then there's and they're Canadian, so they sound like Canadians. And my mother talks about, like, when she talks about, like, don't come home pregnant with a black fella, which is a child. And so there is a message of, like, the racial tones that I grew up with in the 80s, which is, and then I step out and say, wow, that was quite a message to a person who's half this, half that. Because my mother would say stuff like, you know, you can't come home with a black person's child because the baby won't be black or the baby won't be white, right? So again, this sort of messages of duality and looking back at the generational message around other and fear of other. So I would say the scaffolding of the show is about love addiction, but the underbelly is about fear of others. And so all the other characters do point back to that. And then when I go inside my rehab, I excavate my little one, who's like, she's talking and then she splits in two, and then there's two little girls that are exactly alike, and one of them is deaf and one of them is hearing. And then the two of them kind of fight each other, and then there's an integration that needs to happen.
So TL, I think we're just kind of winding up towards the end of the interview. So mm-hmm. if you could tell me, where can people find your work? When is it going to be performed? And where can people find you online?
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, they can find me at Facebook, TL Forsberg. That's probably the easiest place. My show is called The Book That Won't Close, Confessions of a Love Addict. And the next date is June 6th, and it's a live stream performance at the Whitefire Theater. And you can look it up, the book that won't close on Eventbrite. It is the first time we're trying to like keep theater alive because of the whole COVID experience. And my show has won a scholarship awards. I've only done it 3 times, and it's just people are so receptive to the message of it. And then I'm also a scholarship diversity award winner for the Hollywood Fringe, and my show will be showing up in Hollywood Fringe in October.
Great, thank you so much. So we've been talking tonight with playwright T.L. Forsberg, whose new play, which is going to be airing June 6th on live stream, features a trans character as one of the lead characters. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank
Bye.
You.